Okay, welcome back to the Historic Landmarks Commission. The next item on the agenda is a briefing. And we have Brandon Spencer Hartle here to walk us through the HRCP. Thanks, Brandon. And you're muted. Brandon, I think you're still muted.
Better.
There we go.
Chair Minor, can you see my screen share?
Yes.
And how about now?
Yes.
Great. Well, thank you, Commissioners, for having me. Brandon Spencer Hartle, Bureau of Planning and Sustainability. I'm the project manager for the Historic Resources Code Project, which many of you have heard about for a long time. And I'm here today to provide a briefing. I will try to keep it to an hour or less, since I know that everyone's hoping to be off the call by dinner time. And I think we can make up a little bit of time in the briefing. The way I'd like to do this today is really I'm here to bring the commission up to speed with where the staff recommended zoning code amendments are going, to talk a bit about the process over the next 6 weeks as we're out in the public, looking for public feedback, getting testimony, and preparing for a Planning and Sustainability Commission hearing later in October. And so as I go through the PowerPoint today, I would encourage any commissioner to stop me, to ask questions, to engage in dialogue, because my hope today really is to give the full commission enough background for you to review the proposals, deliberate amongst yourselves, and to be best prepared for when I come back on October 12th to engage in a work session with all of you about where it is we're going and to clarify things that may not be clear today. So do feel free to interrupt me as I go through the briefing today. So for newer commissioners, and I know we have a few attendees on the Zoom call today, a little bit of background about why we're here. We're here for a couple of reasons. First is that there have long been calls to update the citywide historic resources inventory, which last happened in 1984. And as part of these code amendments and as part of our work in Salem, working with Department of Land Conservation and Development Commission to change administrative rules, we are hoping that these code amendments give us a clear path for updating the inventory in a phased and methodical way that has been contemplated for quite some time. The last time the zoning code was amended holistically to take a look at historic resource regulations was with the Historic Resources Code Improvement Project in 2013. I don't think there's any commissioner who was on the commission at that time, but staff and certainly commissioners who have been engaged in their personal and professional roles for a long time may remember that effort, which was looking at primarily residential historic districts and the types of projects that were exempt from review and the level of review, the procedure type that would be applied to smaller exterior changes. That project, even though it did make surgical amendments to the historic resource provisions of the code, was not a holistic, comprehensive overview of the code provisions related to historic resources. As most commissioners know, 3 years ago, the Land Conservation and Development Commission adopted new state administrative rules that would govern local government historic preservation activities around the state. We often refer to these as the Goal 5 rules or admin rules. Those rule changes did two things. One, they gave us a mandate to update our historic resource regulations here in the city of Portland. And two, they opened up new opportunities for codifying new procedures such as updating the historic resource inventory, applying design and demolition protections to different types of resources, and giving us a good opportunity to take a complete look at how we are managing historic resources. 2 years ago, the new comprehensive plan went into effect with a variety of goals and policies related to historic preservation. And then last but not least, before and during our earlier phases of historic resource code project, we've heard from a variety of property owners, tenants, staff in multiple bureaus, and the broad interested public in opportunities and constraints that are facing historic resources citywide. So where we're going, I'm here today to brief the commission in advance of our release of the proposed draft of code amendments tomorrow. That proposed draft includes two volumes, one, a staff report with a summary of the proposed amendments, and two, the proposed zoning code changes, as well as the commentary that explains what those changes would accomplish. That's getting released tomorrow. We'll be sending out mailed notice to all historic resource owners citywide, which is about 16,000 property owners. and then holding information sessions just about every day between now and October 27th, when the Planning and Sustainability Commission will hold a formal hearing, inviting the public, inviting this commission, inviting interested parties to testify on the proposed amendments. After the Planning and Sustainability Commission holds that hearing and closes the record, they will go into a series of work sessions, which we may or may not engage Landmarks commissioners, depending on the items that are of interest to the Planning and Sustainability Commission in that work session process. And then we're looking for the Planning and Sustainability Commission to make a recommendation to City Council sometime around the end of this year, so that we can take this project to the last step of the process, which is City Council hearings and adoption, hopefully in spring 2021. And I didn't send commissioners a copy of the code amendments or the staff report. Like I said, those will be out tomorrow morning on the website, and we'll send a link to Chair Minor to share with those commissioners who may be most interested in reviewing the proposals. So just some real quick background. I know you all are experts on this, but I did think I would give you some orientation to what are the types of resources and what it is we'll be talking about. Citywide, we have 735 individually listed historic landmarks. Many of those are also in historic and conservation districts, but individually listed are 735 historic landmarks, 12 conservation landmarks, 20 historic districts, 6 conservation districts, and 898 ranked resources on the historic resources inventory that are not in a historic or conservation district or designated as a landmark. So that's sort of our universe right now of what is recognized as a significant or designated historic resource here in the city. And then again, I know most of you are expert in this, and some of you are more expert than I am, but there's 4 general vehicles that we use to protect historic resources here in the city. We have demolition review, which currently is a City Council review of proposed demolition activities in historic districts and 2 historic landmarks. We have demolition delay, which is a 120-day delay period that applies to conservation landmarks, contributing buildings in conservation districts, and ranked resources on the historic resource inventory. We have historic resource review, which you all are expert in, and just had a good opportunity to do a design advice request for a historic resource review case, but historic resource review is required for historic landmarks and in historic districts, and is optional in conservation landmarks and conservation districts, where those resources can elect to meet the clear and objective community design standards as an alternative to historic resource review. So for those of you who are newer to the commission, or those of you who are maybe in the public here to listen to what the proposals are, that's sort of our 4 main programs for protecting historic resources. Many of the proposals build on or change these 4 areas of protection. I won't read these in full, but as we as we went through the public comments and staff decision making on the items to be included in the proposed draft, staff did provide 5 value statements that underpin the different proposals that you'll see in the proposed draft. These value statements relate to connections to the past, the meaning that historic places provide in the lived experience of Portlanders, the embodied energy of historic buildings and the opportunity to extend the useful life of buildings, the learning potential and the potential for acknowledging, addressing, reversing past harms and engaging Portlanders in that storytelling that historic places offer. A recognition that historic preservation is best achieved when the broad community is engaged in and participates in the historic designation process, and that we have resources that tell underrepresented histories that ought to be prioritized for designation and protection in the future. And last but not least, historic places are most successful when they can evolve to meet the changing needs of people in the city. So those are our 5 value statements that staff felt were embodied in the proposals that are in the proposed draft. So what I'd like to do, and I know some of you are more familiar with the proposals than others, what I want to do is walk through the primary proposals that you'll see in the proposed draft. These proposals are described in detail in the staff report, and the zoning code amendments that would achieve the proposals are delineated in that volume 2 code and commentary report. But what I'd like to do today for the full commission is just to give you a sense of the high point proposals that are in the proposed draft. I won't be going through your earlier memo and responding item by item, I did send a memo to the commission that attempts to give some sense of how we responded to your earlier requests. But I will along the way stop and talk about how we may specifically have responded to commission requests and our changes. But for today, I'm going to give you the broad sense of where it is we're going since it has changed since that earlier discussion draft that the commission last commented on. The first proposal is sort of at the highest level, the 30,000 foot level of how we recognize historic resources citywide. Today, when we talk about the historic resource inventory, what's often being referred to is a specific set of classifications of historic resources. So those resources that were identified in 1984 on the citywide inventory effort, and not those resources that have been designated as a landmark or district, and not those resources that have been documented but not included in that 1984 survey work. Our first and sort of biggest picture proposal is to restructure the phrase HRI, or the historic resource inventory, as the master list of historic places that are designated, identified as significant by the city, or that have been documented. So the inventory, in theory, becomes a living document, a master list, under which we have a variety of resource types that are addressed by the zoning code and some that aren't, that tell the city's stories. And restructuring the historic resource inventory in this way helps us alleviate public confusion that exists today when a landmark owner or a property owner or a district finds out that their resource is not on the inventory because it wasn't documented in 1984. So our first proposal really is to create, and this is not a policy change as much as it is a naming convention change, an umbrella term for historic resource inventory. Under the new sort of structure of a historic resource inventory, one of the opportunities that's presented in the new state administrative rule, and something that we've heard from Portlanders across the board, is that today's historic resource types don't provide enough of a menu of options for protections to capture the breadth and depth of both historic resource significance, as well as the potential for competing community goals and values. Generally today, and you'll see it on the left here, generally today we have a hierarchy of historic resource types that in the code elevates historic landmarks and historic districts that are listed in the National Register to the highest level of protections. City designated historic landmarks and historic districts, which we have very few of that aren't also on the National Register, are given a sort of a silver standard, so the second place in the protection program of the city's hierarchy of historic resource types. Conservation landmarks and conservation districts, which are all city designated, are given effectively a bronze position in our historic resource classifications. And under today's hierarchy of historic resource types, those historic landmarks, conservation landmarks, historic districts, and conservation districts are all considered to be designated historic resources, and they're all subject to some level of demolition and design protection. And we also have those resources that I mentioned that are on the historic resource inventory that were identified in 1984. Some of those, the ranked resources, or rank 1, 2, or 3 resources, were determined by the city to have historic significance. They are subject to demolition delay, but they're not officially designated and subject to a protection program that could stop a demolition or would review the design of an alteration or new construction. At the very bottom of the hierarchy, the zoning code addresses unranked resources. There are no regulations, historic resource regulations, that apply to those, but they are identified as a historic resource type. So below that new umbrella term for historic resource inventory, these code amendments do propose restructuring the hierarchy of historic resources. We would keep 3 tiers of designated resources and 1 tier of resources that were documented, determined significant, but not technically designated. In making this change, we'd be streamlining the number of resource types that the zoning code addresses, and also giving more intentional thought to protecting those city-designated historic resources and using the new National Register framework provided by state administrative rule as the floor for how we'll protect historic resources. I'll come back in a few minutes and talk in detail about the protections that would apply to these different categories of resources. The important thing to know here is that the way we've designed the proposal is if a building is a historic landmark today, it stays a historic landmark under these amendments. If a resource is in a conservation district, it stays a conservation district. And so resources are safe harbored in their current resource type under these amendments. But what we'd be doing is setting up this new hierarchy so that resources could be designated at one of these levels or moved up or down the hierarchy based upon the appropriateness of protections. A couple of changes I want to point out here that are maybe the most meaningful. Since 2017, landmarks and districts that are listed in the National Register have only been subject to the demolition review requirement and not the design review requirement. That was a change that came down from the state in those 2017 changes in administrative rule, and really does give us a mandate for creating a new category of resource, which are resources that have been listed in the National Register and that have no city designation or weren't previously identified as a historic landmark or a historic district here in the city. There are, I think, 10 National Register listings for individual buildings since 2017 that would be renamed National Register landmarks. There are 3 National Register districts, Peacock Lane, Laurelhurst, and the Zoo Railway Historic District. Those would all become the sort of the pioneers of the new classification of National Register Landmark or National Register District. Reason why that's so important is state law is fairly prescriptive on the regulations that we can apply and must apply to National Register listings. And the staff worked through comments in the discussion draft and what we heard from the public, we really felt like it made the most sense in the hierarchy of the code to put those National Register listed resources at the sort of the bronze standard or the floor protection on which city designations would build. Locally designated historic landmarks and districts would assume the top place in the hierarchy of protections, and city designated conservation landmarks and conservation districts would effectively become the middle tier of the designated resources. And we would rename rank 1, 2, 3 resources on the inventory as significant resources so that we could reallocate the phrase historic resource inventory to mean everything on this new hierarchy of resources, as well as things that might be documented but have no zoning code regulations that apply. Just as a little more background, as I mentioned just a minute ago, Laurelhurst and Peacock Lane would fall into this new National Register District's resource type, as would any other resource that was listed in the National Register after 2017. Those places that were listed in the National Register before 2017 that are identified as historic landmarks and historic districts, places like the Grand Avenue Historic District, for example, or Pittock Mansion, they would stay historic landmarks and historic districts. So the only places that would get a new name out of these code amendments are those places that were listed after 2017, or those places that are ranked resources that become significant resources. And just to give a quick map of where those districts are, effectively, the places that we know of as historic districts today or conservation districts today would keep that name. It's only those new National Register districts that would get the new name going forward. If an Eastmoreland Historic District or a, let's say a new Overlook Historic District were listed in the National Register but had no city designation, it would fall into this new category of National Register District or National Register Landmark. I'm going to pause there since this is sort of a big shift in how we organize historic resources in the code, and I wouldn't be surprised if there's a question or two from the commission, and if not, I'll keep rolling, but I will pause there just for a moment.
This is Commissioner Mahoney. Brandon, can you explain why, so pre 2017 it's going to be confusing to talk about historic districts that are nationally ranked pre 2017, post 2017. Post 2017 aren't automatically made into city. There has to be a process for that. Is that correct?
So versus
pre 2017.
Right, so before 2017, everything that was listed in the National Register was automatically given a historic landmark or historic district identification in the city's code and on the city's zoning map. And so when, let's use Irvington, was listed in the National Register, Irvington automatically became identified as a historic district here in the city.
So in the proposed hierarchy, it's the gold standard, right?
That's right.
Is that true? So then anything, this post 2017 that it's not a city landmark is the bronze standard?
Okay. That would be right. And part of that's because state administrative rules say anything listed in the National Register after 2017 cannot have design protections applied to it unless or until the local government designates it as a local historic landmark or district. And so okay. We can't apply historic resource review of the community design standards to newly listed National Register resources.
Okay, thank you for reminding me about that.
Hey, Brandon, this is Commissioner Spears. I guess one thing being new to this, I think we've talked about this in the past, and you don't have to do this right now. I still don't know what the definitions are of like even our local stuff, like our conservation landmarks, our conservation districts, our historic landmarks. And then I also don't know what protections that offers the people who are on it, because my understanding is that there wasn't a lot of teeth in it. And what is that going to afford someone in the future so they can not go through some things? And I'm just relating to, you know, businesses that probably should have been on there that are having to go through some city things now. So I guess my question is, one is, I really want to know what that definition is. I really want to know what protection is that affording? And then I guess my other question would be is that when we talk about the groups who haven't had the ability to get these protections, and I think of, you know, we talk about the historic African American neighborhood. I could also bring up Harvey Milk. There used to be a protection zone for LGBTQ+ members. I don't know how we get that back without having to wait that same amount of time for them to be written back into a program. So I guess I'm trying to figure out those different pieces right now. And I don't know, again, you don't have to answer everything right now. This is just where my mind is going.
Derek, you're going to like theme 2 and theme 3, which are designation and protection, because you're right there with us in thinking about how all this fits together. And so at the highest level, what this proposal is doing is giving us a framework and saying there are some resources that we protect at the gold level, some at the silver, some at the bronze, and some in sort of an eligibility standard. And by restructuring a hierarchy and having an intentional set of resource types, then we can talk about what types of resources are eligible for designation and what those protections look like that align to the different levels, all building off of state required protections for National Register listings. One thing I will just mention quickly here, you saw in the transition the sort of hierarchy diagrams, those unranked resources identified in 1984's historic resource inventory effort are not carried over into the new hierarchy. And that's because we are proposing to remove unranked resources from the zoning code. They're in the zoning code today as a historic resource type. There are no regulations that apply to those properties, and they were not determined in 1984 to be eligible for a designation. So we're proposing to take those out of the zoning code, but keep the documentation in that new umbrella HRI for public informational purposes. That documentation would still be out there. You could still find it. It just wouldn't be addressed by the zoning code any longer. So this starts to get to Derek's question, which is, okay, well, we're proposing a new hierarchy. We're reordering the different resource types that we have today. What are we gonna do with that? At the most foundational level, when there have been requests that have come in for updating the historic resource inventory, and when the comprehensive plan has talked about the historic resource inventory, part of that has meant, how do we get back out there and survey historic resources around the city, document places, and evaluate whether or not they're eligible for a future designation as a landmark or district? And so we have a proposal that would, as I mentioned earlier, rename the ranked resources to significant resources and establish a procedure by which the Historic Landmarks Commission would make a recommendation to City Council to add new significant resources. So significant resources are not designated. They're essentially resources that are eligible for a designation in the future that have been documented and evaluated and are in a holding pattern until a property owner consents to designation or a group of owners get together and propose a historic or conservation district. Today's code requires owner consent for us to establish new resources as significant on the HRI. And today's code has the Historic Landmarks Commission as the decision maker. That is vestigial language from the 1980s. The Landmarks Commission isn't chartered to make decisions like this to update the zoning map. And so there's been a standstill for the better part of 30, 35 years for getting things moving on updating the inventory. And so this proposal would give the Landmarks Commission the power to recommend to council, much like you do with new historic district design guidelines, the ability to add or remove resources from that significant resource category, effectively saying these are resources that are important, they are eligible for a future designation, and we want to elevate them to that place. Once we've gone out there and done that work of identifying which resources might be eligible for designation, and knowing that there are property owners who are interested in historic designations, Proposal 2B would revise the criteria and the procedures for locally designating, amending, and removing landmark and district status. We don't have the authority to change the National Register criteria or the National Park Service's decisions to list or remove the listing of resources, so all we have the authority to address in the zoning code is designation at the local level. This is historic landmark, conservation landmark, historic district, conservation district status. And so in that hierarchy of resources that I showed earlier, we're really talking about protections, but we also need to have, like Derek mentioned, good definitions about what are the different resource types, why are they different, what are the criteria by which an applicant can demonstrate that they should be a historic landmark or a conservation landmark. Who makes those decisions? And so what you'll see in the proposal are new criteria that include the National Park Service criteria for areas of historic significance and the National Park Service criteria around integrity. But you'll also see additional criteria related to underrepresented histories and cultural and historic resources citywide that maybe in the past haven't been elevated for a local designation. You'll also see in the proposed draft code that listing of a landmark is something that can happen quasi-judicially. So an applicant can come in and say, I want to make my commercial building in East Portland a conservation landmark. They can do that through a quasi-judicial land use procedure where staff or the Historic Landmarks Commission, depending on the nature of the proposal, would make a decision to designate. Or they could go forward in a legislative procedure, maybe as part of one of those inventory updates, maybe as part of a group of resources that are proposed for landmark designation. And in that process to designate a historic or conservation landmark, much like with the significant resource identification, the Landmarks Commission would be the recommending body to City Council and City Council would be the decision maker. Oregon law does require owner consent for landmark designation. And so we would never be designating a landmark under these criteria and under this process without owner consent to listing. For districts, there's a couple things that have changed from the earlier discussion draft. We are proposing that districts would be listed but only by the City Council, only through a legislative procedure where the Planning and Sustainability Commission makes a recommendation to Council, and the Historic Landmarks Commission is advising both the PSC and Council in that decision. In the earlier discussion draft, we had a proposal that would allow for small districts to be created quasi-judicially, and we had a lack of approval criteria that would apply. You'll see in the proposed draft that we have eliminated the quasi-judicial listing option for small districts, and we have approval criteria that mirror the conservation historic levels for landmarks for designation of a district. And so to get at Commissioner Spears's question, this proposal and theme of proposals is really where we're looking to get at the criteria for listing and the procedure for listing as a historic or conservation landmark or district.
Brandon?
Yep.
I do have another question, if you don't mind. When you talked about the identifying of significant resources, who's identifying that?
That's a good question. Generally, in a legislative procedure, it would be something that city staff would bring forward. And so there's a few ways that might work. There might be a bucket of requests that come in from property owners who say, I'm not quite ready to get designated as a landmark, but I do think I have an important place and I'd like it to be identified as a significant resource. Or as part of a broad planning effort, city staff, myself, Hillary, our colleagues, may go out and document or work with property owners to document historic places and bring it forward to the commission. Similarly, the commission might be requesting, for example, city council or the bureaus allocate funding in the future to go out and do these targeted survey efforts. We did last year do a pilot survey in the Montevilla Main Street area. That in that survey, we identified a small handful of buildings that are likely eligible for landmark designation. Once these code amendments are adopted, I would be bringing forward to this commission the proposal for, let's have these 8 resources identified as significant resources in Montevilla, so that they're sort of waiting in the wings for a future designation if and when those owners are interested in doing that.
And I guess, you know, my passion is how do we continue to get our city and the people in the city involved in the process? Because I hear a lot of how it comes back through us and it comes back through a lot of things. And personally, it just raises a lot of alarms just for a lot of different reasons. I mean, we're having a lot of these discussions and the terminology is who's been in the room, because in the past, there were people in the room who didn't allow groups to get registered. And my concern is that I don't know how we get our public involved in the process, in the conversation, even if it's designating how they become involved, because it's no more than a shift and change in our city council or our historic landmark commission, because we can't be here forever before somebody else is in the room to make decisions on how they want to bring forward the conversation. So, I mean, this is just higher level things I have to think about, but it does still strike a little bit of a red flag for me, because the room is going to change at some point in time. And what does the conversation look like then, and who's represented, and how does that conversation move forward? Because again, we got here because of people in the room who decided not to push conversations forward. So I guess that's just kind of where I still have some concerns on truly getting back to, I don't mind, you know, us being involved in BPS, and there's a lot of great people there and what we all do. I'm always just trying to push on how do we get our city involved? How do they know what's there? How do they know to get that information? How do they get involved? How do they bring forth nominations? How do they get to approve designations? They should be involved, you know, no more than they vote for taxes. They should be involved in what their city is preserving. And so I'll always continue to push that narrative on how we add them into the process. And I know we're reflections of that, but we're a person. So, you know, I have my own set of biases just like everybody else does. And I just want to make sure that we are truly trying to incorporate our city into the conversation to make sure they know what's going on. Because they don't get to do these calls and have these conversations. Again, this is no reflection on anything here. It's just the alarms that kind of raises in my mind, even looking at current events of who's in the room making decisions on other levels of this country. And it concerns me. So, it's kind of the same thing. So I just want to bring that back up as we continue to move into this and what that looks like and identifying those pieces.
And to Commissioner Spear's point, I think you're exactly right. And to date, we haven't done, there's been no updating to that sort of citywide big look at historic resources since the 1980s. And the overwhelming majority of our designation decisions have been the result of National Park Service, National Register listings. And so what we haven't seen is the broad involvement of people citywide in documenting historic places, bringing forward new, interesting, underrepresented histories for identification as significant or designation and protection. And so this really is this theme, and I'd love to see you get your eyes on it and start to develop some thoughts on how we could do it better, or if this is the right answer. This theme of designation is really intended to get us out of what's been a neutral space where the only listings that have happened in the last 25 years have generally been the result of an owner or a group of owners who are seeking National Register status. And the National Register is a pretty high bar for historic significance. And it's also been something that has been pretty selectively used for a pretty narrow group of resource types. So I think you're exactly onto it. And what you'll see in this theme is the Planning Bureau's best attempt to move us in that direction, to have more public process, a broader menu of options for how to recognize those historic resources and the right land use process for having that get into the zoning code or the official zoning map.
And I also want to say, I just want to make sure, because I am very thankful for the direction we are going, because we are moving in the right direction. You know, I always just continue to push the narrative a little bit further and see how much we can do, knowing we have a lot of limitations. So I'm very thankful for the work that's being done. You know, it's just, I'm always going to have my questions in my conversation around that particular piece to make sure we are really getting to where we're going to, while acknowledging this is a fix, you know, and a improvement on what's happened, an improvement on conversation, and we still probably have a little more ways to go. So I just want to bring those pieces. I'm very thankful of all the work. I don't ever want to make that sound like I'm not. I just always have questions and red flags and things that come up. So,
and the last thing I'll say on this, and this is something that we heard quite a bit up from the public, and not necessarily this commission. But we heard a lot from the public about the designation and the protection of districts. That was the area of public feedback that we heard the most about. And in the staff proposal, you'll see that to create a new historic district or conservation district, it would be the Planning and Sustainability Commission and not this commission making a recommendation to City Council. And we went around and around for a long time about who that right review body is. But based upon the feedback we received in the earlier versions of the drafts, the feedback we received is that the Planning and Sustainability Commission was a better recommending body to City Council because of their balancing act of goals and policies of the comprehensive plan. And whether or not a proposed local historic or conservation district would have effects on other land use goals or other land use policies that might affect the broad geographic area. So I suspect that last bullet point on the district process really will be something that there will be a lot of feedback to Planning and Sustainability Commission about on October 27.
Yeah, that was the question I had about why the PSCs and why aren't we also, I guess, listed in addition. I mean, I guess I can understand they'd want to take a broader overview of how it relates to planning as a whole, but it worries me a little bit that there's competing interests that could come into play.
And I think to Annie's point about the competing interests were the concern that was identified with the creation of districts generally, that a larger geographic area has a lot of things going on as it relates to the underlying base zoning, as it relates to proximity to transit. And the feedback we got was that only the Planning and Sustainability Commission could make a recommendation to council that's balancing all of those other land use objectives. What I didn't put here in the process chart was that the Landmarks Commission would be, much like with these code amendments, advisory to PSC and advisory to council, making a recommendation, much like you will, I'm sure, on these code proposals, but that you wouldn't be the formal body to recommend to council. Whenever City Council takes on a land use proposal, there is a recommending body. It's either the Design Commission, the Landmarks Commission, or the Planning and Sustainability Commission for a legislative change. And so this would be the one place in these code amendments where PSC would be the recommending body and not the Landmarks Commission.
Could you, sorry to belabor it, but could you give me an example of why that would be a benefit for them to be reviewing? Like, I don't know, I just can't really, I don't have enough experience to understand how that would come into play as a benefit. So
let's say there were a proposed listing of, I'm just going to pick Montevilla for ease of simplicity here, and there's no proposal to do this in Montevilla. But let's say there was a proposal to designate a new Montevilla Conservation District. And that proposal ultimately needed to go to City Council for a decision. And Montevilla is a place where there's a patchwork of zoning that's been applied. There are sites that are identified in the buildable lands inventory. There are vested owner interests in potential redevelopment or restoration of buildings. And the PSC as a body is the ones responsible for making recommendations to council about changing the zoning and the allowances in Montevilla. as a part of the city. And the feedback that we received in the public process said, because of historic or conservation district will have a meaningful effect on the way land can be used and developed, and because there are many property owners who would be affected, the PSC is a necessary gatekeeper in getting that recommendation to council to weigh and balance whether or not it's appropriate to apply regulations protecting historic resources when previous land use decisions have been made. Effectively, to make the case that because districts are large in size and they may create conflicts with previous zoning decisions about how those areas are intended to grow and change, PSC would be the recommending body in a way that they have the expertise about those previous land use decisions, about what was anticipated to happen in those places. Unlike an individual landmark designation where it's one owner, they're the ones who are making the request, or at least they've given their owner consent. And it might not have a broad effect on the ability of the land use vision in a certain place to come to fruition or not.
So which means, well, I just immediately jumped to Chinatown, Japantown, and the height designations and issues there. So I guess that's where I get a little bit worried, is that then you start to get districts that might be carved up, you know, for like, well, we really think this should stay, you know, buildable to 250. We don't want, you know, HLC to be able to say that it can't be this high. I kind of go to the worst pessimistic.
I'd add your thinking on this too, Annie, that with this hierarchy of historic resource types, an owner or a group of owners or a review body could propose moving a resource up or down that hierarchy. So we'll take your example as conservation landmark here in the photo, just for an example. That owner might ask to have their conservation landmark, the designation changed to a historic landmark, or to have their designation removed. There are approval criteria that are included in the proposed draft for what would have to be considered for that decision making. But ultimately, this criteria for designation and the process for designation would apply to new designations, changes in the existing designation, or proposed removal of designation. Criteria for all of that are provided in the proposed draft. And so to your point, it may not be just a new district that falls into this category, but it might be a proposal to change the place on the hierarchy of an existing district, or to remove a district designation altogether.
Okay.
We have not, the city council has not designated a new district since 1993. And previous to 2017, unanimous owner consent was required to list a new district. With those changes in state rules, only 50% owner consent is necessary to list a new district. And so the city has not been a formal decision maker in creating new historic conservation districts since the early 1990s. It's all been punted to the National Park Service. Those changes in state rules say you still have to recognize National Register districts. They still have demolition protections, but to apply design protections or to create new local districts, cities only need 50% owner consent to make that decision. And so there's a new opening that really is a book that's been closed for the better part of 25 years that now is open again, saying the city council does have a role, or can have a role, in the creation, removal, or change of historic and conservation districts. One thing I should mention, this is a piece of feedback we got from this commission. Individual buildings that are listed in the National Register could be designated as a local historic landmark or conservation landmark through a Type 1 staff decision. And one of the things that we wanted to do in these proposals was, if you are going on the National Register and you're wanting to have your building be subject to additional protections, we want it to be as easy as possible for that individual owner to do that. We're not proposing that process for districts, but for sake of example, if the Billy Webb Elks Lodge, which just recently was listed on the National Register, if they were interested in conservation landmark or historic landmark status, that would apply the design protections, unlock incentives for that property. If they were interested in that local designation, they could do that through a type one staff decision. And under the current fee structure, it's a relatively nominal cost to do that. So I'm going to move us to the protection discussion, which is really where the hierarchy rubber hits the road, and how we protect designated historic resources and with our design demolition protection tools. So today, demolition review is a city council decision. It only applies to resources that are listed in the National Register. So I showed in that hierarchy earlier, city designated historic landmarks and districts were in that solver position. That's because they have historic resource review. They don't have demolition review. So if you look at a resource like, maybe this is a faux pas because it may be a current case, but the Benson High School, for example, city designated historic landmark, not on the National Register, not subject to demolition review under our current regulations. Conservation landmarks, conservation districts, while city designated, while they've gone through the process to have their historic significance documented and confirmed, while they have design protections that apply, they are only subject to demolition delay. The code proposals would apply demolition review to all designated historic landmarks, conservation landmarks, and National Register landmarks, and similarly apply demolition review to all contributing resources and districts. This is a pretty big move. It applies demolition review to a little over 2,000 properties that today are subject to demolition delay. Of all the code proposals, this one is maybe the biggest change in regulation in terms of the intensity regulation, but also in terms of the number of properties affected. But to get it right, we're proposing to expand the demolition review approval criteria that can be met to gain approval for demolition of some of those lower tier resources. And this is going to be a fun one for discussion, and having the review body for demolition review for conservation and National Register level resources be the Historic Landmarks Commission and not the City Council. So this commission would absorb a new quasi-judicial review responsibility, reviewing and making decisions on demolition applications for those National Register and conservation level resources. And we're proposing to keep the Type 4 City Council review for that gold standard, the historic landmarks and historic districts. A couple other things that happen here, we would exempt accessory structures from demolition review for all resource types except for historic landmarks and historic districts. In historic landmarks and historic districts today, garages, sheds, outbuildings that are identified as contributing are subject to City Council Type 4 demo review. We would change that to a Type 2 staff level review. That's about 1,700 properties that would move out of City Council review and down to a staff level review. To do that, we'd establish the new Type 2 procedure. And like I mentioned a minute ago, we would establish a new Type 3 procedure for demolition of contributing buildings and landmarks that are at the Conservation or National Register levels. And you, Landmarks Commission, would be the review body for that. To better differentiate those resource types that are lower on the hierarchy, that don't have demo review today and maybe getting it, we're proposing to expand the list of approval criteria that can be met to gain approval for demo review. Today, there's only two criteria that apply to demo review. One is economic hardship. The other is better meeting the goals and policies of the comprehensive plan. Staff still feel like those are good approval criteria for the most significant, the most protected resources. But at those lower levels of designation types, that there's an opportunity to expand the list of criteria to look at some new and interesting ways to mitigate for the loss of historic buildings when they're proposed for demolition in a place like a conservation district. I suspect this proposal for demolition review will be something that the public will be quite interested in, and I expect a lot of testimony at Planning Commission around the application demolition review, but also the approval criteria and the procedure types that might apply in these resources that are in those lower rungs of the hierarchy that we're proposing. And I will stop there just in case there's any questions on the demolition proposal. All right, so we're going to go a little deeper into the brass tacks here. This is something that I came and talked to the commission about maybe 4 months ago, which is that when historic resource review is required, there are a list of items that are exempt from review. We call these exemptions. Exemptions are generally minor exterior alterations that are nominal in their effect and that that are benign enough that historic resource review is not necessary to preserve the integrity of a resource. Today's exemptions are work items like repair, maintenance, minor exterior changes to add vents, changing basement windows on non-street facing facades. There's a lengthy list of work items that are exempt from review. Proposal 3B would expand that list of exemptions. This was included in the discussion draft. Staff have expanded it even further in the proposed draft. I'm not going to go over all these today because they're technical and they're varied. In general, we're proposing more new exemptions for districts than we are for landmarks, recognizing that the individual structure of a landmark itself has to carry enough integrity to tell its significant story. A district that is comprised of dozens or hundreds or even thousands of properties, maybe there's more room for a little bit of change. But there are a couple of primary new exemptions that I think this commission will be interested in and is informed by my last visit to you back in the spring. National Register landmarks and districts would be exempt from historic resource review. So just altogether, no historic resource review for those newly listed National Register landmarks and districts. That's a requirement of the state administrative rule. And so we're putting that clearly in the code. We would retain the community design standards option for conservation landmarks and districts. So if you're subject to historic resource review in a conservation district or you're a conservation landmark owner, you could go to those clear and objective measurable alternative standards. And we're not proposing any changes to those standards. And then we would be expanding the list of exemptions. The two biggest ones that I think will be of interest across the board is that we are expanding the solar panel exemption to allow solar panels on landmarks that face the rear property line and allow solar panels in historic districts that face the rear and side property lines. The panels would need to be parallel to the roof and couldn't project more than 8 inches from the face of the roof, and nor could they overhang roof edges or ridge lines. And so this is a big move in our historic districts. We did receive quite a bit of public feedback about this item early on, and staff really felt like with the thin profile of new solar panels and where these regulations would apply that we might be best served to have a new exemption for solar panels. You would still need to go through historic resource review if you were proposing solar panels on the front-facing roof slope, or if you were proposing solar panels on a roof that was not, that were not parallel to the roof when there's a sloped roof. The other exemption, this is one that staff went around and around about, and Commissioner Roman gave us some really good insights to think about and some good examples to think about. We are proposing a new exemption for accessory structures. It's smaller than what I had talked about with the commission before. So what's on the table is no wall longer than 20 feet. We had talked about 24 last time. I think Commissioner Roman was encouraging us to go with something smaller than 20, but we landed on 20. But there would need to be siding that matched. There'd be limitations on the windows that would be allowed, and there'd be limitations on the roof slope. And so we are creating sort of a standards path for small detached accessory structures. The idea here really is that in historic and conservation districts that are residentially zoned, there's opportunities to create housing or opportunities to create new living area in the backyards of properties. And that if we could find a standards path to get there in a way that still upholds the historic integrity of the district, but does provide owners with a streamlined and efficient path to add dwelling units, that is what we're looking to do. So these would be small detached accessory structures. I'm sure there will be a lot of feedback about this at Planning and Sustainability Commission, but the idea really is to create a path for sort of a form-based approach that works in historic and conservation districts. I should say today there is an exemption for 200 square foot detached accessory structures. And so effectively we're doubling the size of what's currently allowed and exempt. And any project that's proposed that doesn't need one of these exemptions could go through historic resource review So if you're proposing solar on the street-facing roof slope or a big ADU in the backyard, you could still make that proposal and go through historic resource review for consideration. Any questions on exemptions? So I mentioned that an applicant could choose to go through historic.
Sorry, Brandon. Sorry, is there a height limitation on the accessory structure, or is it just square footage?
There is. It's 15, okay. 15 feet.
15 feet, okay.
To the midpoint of the gable.
Okay, thanks.
So I mentioned historic resource review. We are proposing some changes to the general historic resource review approval criteria. We're not proposing any changes to the design guidelines that apply in historic districts. Where guidelines apply, we're leaving those, generally leaving those alone. We're not affecting any of the guideline approval criteria. But we are taking a look at the general historic resource review approval criteria that apply to landmark structures and apply in districts without design guidelines. Primarily, these refinements would affect districts that have no design guidelines. So that's Irvington, the Kenton Commercial Historic District, the Washington Park Reservoirs, and would affect proposals that are replacing detached accessory structures. And we'll go into that too much today, but we are looking to refine the approval criteria. We're being pretty narrow in how we're doing it. And generally what we're doing is making some surgical changes to what we call 060G around here, which is the city's version of the Secretary of the Interior Standards. Like I said, this applies to all landmarks and districts without guidelines today. We're making those changes to make those criteria work better in districts without guidelines and allow for replacement detached accessory structures as an alternative to demolition review. I won't get too much into that right now since it's a little complicated, but we've been pretty surgical. It's really similar to what was in the discussion draft. And I guess there's one big thing I would say about that. One challenge, and this is like commissioners will be familiar with this. One challenge that exists in these criteria today is that they were written and intended for landmarks and not intended necessarily for a big district like Irvington. Irvington has no district specific design guidelines, so these general approval criteria apply district wide in Irvington. And the existing criteria talk about compatibility with adjacent properties. Adjacent properties is a pretty vague term that may or may not mean contributing buildings, that if it's part of a sub pattern might not be the best criterion to use to assess compatibility. And so we are proposing to change the phrase adjacent properties to contributing buildings within 200 feet. I'm sure this is something that Irvington Community Association will give us some thoughts on, but one area we are looking to change is to give decision makers greater clarity about what does compatibility look like in a district that doesn't have guidelines. Since when these criteria were drafted, Irvington wasn't a historic district and we weren't thinking about an area that included 3,000 properties. And so that is an area of change that I think that those property owners who would be affected by it will give us something to say. We started new down this road in the discussion draft, but we landed on an answer in the proposed draft that really is seeking to give us clarity in Irvington. You'll see two other things in the approval criteria. One, conservation landmarks today are subject to the historic landmark approval criteria. There's only a dozen conservation landmarks today. What we expect with this new hierarchy of resource types that more may be listed in the future. We are proposing a new set of criteria for conservation landmarks that take the historic landmark criteria and narrow them down to be more flexible and to really be looking at the preservation of the materials, features, architectural details, but allowing additions, alterations that might not be appropriate for a historic landmark, thinking about that hierarchy. And then last but not least, we are proposing new criteria for building relocations. So today we don't have criteria that apply to relocations. They are rare, but we wanted to have criteria that would apply so that we could evaluate relocation proposals within the context of criteria that make sense. And then last on the protection theme, this is a pretty minor one. Where 120-day demolition delay applies today, which is a variety of places, we're proposing to limit it just to significant resources in the future. We'd be proposing applying demolition review to all the designated resources. And so demolition delay would only apply to significant resources in the future. And we are proposing to ensure that demolition delay corresponds with the demolition permit application. So today what we see is resource owners, if we would say in today's terminology, ranked resources on the inventory, are coming off of the inventory after a 120-day delay when there's no proposal to demolish. This would tie the two things together so that demolition delay really was accompanied by a proposal to demolish a building, not a preventative measure to remove a building from the inventory and have its current rank status, proposed significant status, removed. So this is a somewhat of a housekeeping item. We hear about this regularly when owners of resources subject to the delay come in for their 120-day waiting period, come off, and those resources aren't demolished, but the city has lost the documentation on the building and the ability to trigger that delay period when a real demolition shows up. I'm gonna stop again there. After this slide, I'm gonna roll us into our last couple themes, which go pretty fast. So I will pause and see if anyone has questions on these protection programs.
Quick question, Brandon, on the relocation. Is that intended to be moving a building to another site, or is it really intended to get at even on the same site?
Really intended for a new site. And okay. These criteria come from a couple of places. One, we have seen some proposals to move buildings in recent years. But two, and most important, is state administrative rule does tell the city that any proposal to relocate a building on the National Register needs to have a public hearing that considers certain factors before that relocation can be approved. And so we have a mandate from the state to have a process with criteria for relocation of at least National Register resources. Since we're restructuring that hierarchy of historic resources to make National Register resources the bronze standard on the floor, we've applied that to other resource types. We are providing some exemptions to that relocation review, like a minor relocation. If you were to move a building up and over a foot or two, and you're jacking building up to add an accessory dwelling unit underneath, if you were relocating a detached accessory structure, we are providing a variety of exemptions to that review where we think it makes sense.
Okay.
So the second to last theme, and this one, just to be honest with all of you, this is the one that I am the most excited about because I think that we have a lot of opportunity here to think about how our historic resources can do more to meet current and future needs of Portlanders, and to do more to engage the full community in experiencing those resources, whether they're a landmark or a district, through commercial uses, through residential uses, through a more intense utilization of this resource that we already have. And so there's three ways that we're proposing to really encourage adaptive reuse and the sort of maximization of how our historic resources can give back to the city today and going forward. First is that we are proposing to eliminate all parking requirements from designated historic resources. When we launched this project a couple years ago, this was a sort of a I don't want to say a big idea, but it was a more controversial proposal. With the residential infill project exempting parking requirements in residential zones, there are only a small number of circumstances in the future where parking would be required, but we're still moving forward with a proposal that would exempt parking requirements from historic landmarks and in districts at all levels of the hierarchy. One of the more nuanced parts of the proposal is that we are proposing to go where we were going in the discussion draft and go even further in allowing uses that aren't otherwise permitted by the code to take place in certain designated resources. Today, generally, the way buildings can be reused is limited by what the underlying base zoning or the plan district zoning is. We did see City Council make some moves with the Better Housing by Design and residential info project that would allow some additional uses, some new uses in historic areas. But we're proposing to go even further than that in historic landmarks, conservation landmarks, historic districts, and conservation districts. So those places that have design and demolition protections, thinking a bit about if resources are protected from design that is incompatible or they're protected from demolition, what can we give to property owners and what can we give to the community to maximize the use of those places? So a flavor of what it is we're proposing, we would propose to go beyond RIP in the number of dwelling units that would be allowed in single dwelling zones. Properties would still be limited to the FAR caps that were adopted by City Council recently in the residential infill project. In an R5 zone, no more than 0.8 FAR, but we would eliminate the unit number cap. So you could take a big house and convert it into 6, 8, 10 dwelling units. And we'd be guaranteeing that 2 ADUs would be allowed in single dwelling zones in combination with a house, duplex, quadplex, sixplex. If two of the dwelling units could be ADUs. And so that goes beyond RIP in the number of units that can be considered ADU in the sort of multifamily housing situations. And so that's a big move. Again, it's maybe less of a big move than it was earlier on before council had adopted residential infill project, but we are moving to a form-based approach to residential density in historic and conservation areas. We're also proposing to allow accessory commercial uses in certain parts of residential zones. What this means is if you have a house, and I'll give an example here, if you have a house in a conservation district or historic district, and you're close to public transit, and you keep the number of residential dwelling units that are on the site, you could have an accessory commercial use. This might look like converting a garage into a boutique or offering tea sales in your backyard. We would be allowing accessory commercial uses when you're near transit and when you haven't reduced the number of dwelling units in residential zones. We go even further for landmarks in residential zones. So historic and conservation landmarks in residential zones would be outright allowed to be retail sales and service or office uses. We would not require that the number of dwelling units be retained on the site, allowing sort of the broadest flexibility in individual landmark structures. There are a good number of landmark structures in residential zones, but citywide there's not that many. And we are really interested in giving those landmarks the greatest opportunity for economic viability and getting the community access to those buildings through new and creative uses. And then last but not least, we are proposing a major adaptive reuse incentive for landmarks. This would be citywide, generally regardless of the zone, though prime industrial zone would not be allowed to take advantage of this. Citywide, owners of landmarks could propose major adaptive reuse into a variety of uses regardless of the zone, but they would be subject to a historic preservation incentive review to determine that they could mitigate for the effects, you know, off the building. I apologize, I'm at my mom's house and she has some barking dogs, so you'll have to bear with that for a minute. And so this reuse incentive really is going beyond protections and thinking about what can historic resources do to maximize their purpose, to maximize their continued viability, but also get the greatest number of Portlanders to experience and appreciate these historic places. And last up, this is a really small thing, so I won't talk about it much. We're streamlining the requirements and applicability to transfer unused FAR. Here's an example of a National Register listed historic landmark that transferred its FAR, and so we are looking to make FAR transfer a little easier, but we're not necessarily going back and relitigating any recent City Council decisions about where FAR transfer is allowed to come from and to go. So I told you all I'd try to be done by 5:30, and so I'm going to go through our last two slides here. They're pretty simple, straightforward, and administrative, but the last one does concern the Landmarks Commission's roles and makeup. We talked about it before, but I do want to make sure I get a minute to talk about that. Throughout the code, to ensure that these code proposals are effective and that the zoning code is conforming with those changes, there's a variety of revisions to purpose statements, procedure types, and associated language in Title 33 and Title 32, the sign code. Largely, this is our cleanup work to make sure that the code works to advance these proposals. A couple ways that would play out on the ground. We'd be amending the procedure types for a variety of proposals. Today, a sign application is a Type 1X proposal. We're proposing to become a Type 1 proposal. New accessory structure in a historic district is a Type 1 proposal. We're proposing to become a Type 1X proposal. So a variety of changes that align the impact of proposed projects with the review procedure and therefore the timeline fee and public visibility of the review to make sure that our procedures are working and that we've best aligned impact with process. And then one big change is that we're proposing that new buildings that are less than 5,000 square feet in historic districts would be subject to a type 2 review and not necessarily a type 3 review. What this means is if someone is proposing a house-like building in a historic district, they would go to a staff level review and not a review by the full Historic Landmarks Commission. That review would be appealable to the commission, but given the impact on districts of a building less than 5,000 square feet and the cost associated and the timeline associated with type 3 review, we are proposing a type 2 review now for those smaller new construction projects. And the last thing is we're making a few surgical changes to the role and makeup of the Landmarks Commission. This does not change any of your commission membership, so you can't get out of the commission because of this one. So if you're itching to go and enjoy your Monday some other way, I'm not here to help you with that. But what we are proposing to do is to broaden the categories of membership so that when you all and BDS goes out in the future to look for new commission members, we've got a diverse set of categories of where those members can be drawn from. And then to your annual report, generally in the past, the annual report has aligned somewhat with the fiscal year. We are revising the timeline in the code that your annual report will get delivered to City Council in the spring, which you've done the last couple of years, which aligns with when City Council is considering the budget and allows staff to organize calendar year counts of how many reviews and what types of projects happen in any given calendar year. And then we would be doing sort of that cleanup to amend your role in designation, decision-making, and determinations of significant resources as per those earlier proposals. So I know that was a mouthful. No other interest group is gonna get this belabored of a briefing than you guys, but I wanted to come to the commission before we released our staff report and code so you had a sense of where we were going, why we were going that direction. I will be out in the community over the next 6 weeks virtually, briefing neighborhood associations, interest groups, groups of property owners, individuals and organizations who commented on previous drafts, historic district advisory groups, and the Planning and Sustainability Commission on October 12th in advance of that October 27th public hearing. And so what I'd like to do is stop there. We're about 5:25 and I can stick around as long as you all want to. But really what I wanted to do is to give the full commission in an hour and 15 minutes, the sort of big picture overview where we're going. There's a lot to digest here. And so I think I will stop and see if there's any Q&A we want to do today. And my plan is to be back on October 12th for all of you to start asking me detailed questions about why we made certain decisions and how things would be implemented as you dig into the code proposals. And I guess I'll just end with, I think I'm really excited about the proposals. This is something we've thought about for a number of years in this code project, but it really is the culmination of the better part of a decade of thinking statewide around how protections, incentives, programs, can work better to ensure that historic resources are really aligned with our broad community goals and values. And there are some pieces of the proposal where the scale tilts a little bit more towards change. And there are some parts of the proposals where the scale is tilting more towards ensuring that we don't lose resources to demolition. But on balance, I think it's gonna be a really good, really good discussion at Planning and Sustainability Commission. We're gonna hear from a lot of people. I am excited about the proposals, but I'm even more excited to see how they land and people like Commissioner Spears who are going to ask tough questions. So that is what I've got to offer today.
Brandon, thank you so much. This is a really helpful walkthrough of a lot of very complicated information that we'll all be sinking our teeth into. I have a couple of maybe just comments right now regarding historic districts as well as individual resources. You know, we're in this funny spot right now. We are one of the very few places in the United States, actually, where National Register sort of automatically gives you protections. You know, like for instance, up in Seattle, they don't do it that way. It's purely honorific. You know, the state of Washington has a, you know, a different designation program. So I think we're trying to move, you know, Oregon, you know, with all these sort of steps, as complicated as it is, we're trying to move towards, you know, a model that is more typically used. I also want to, you know, as I have definitely a few concerns with designation of historic districts and support there. I do want to remind everyone this is just, you know, really a long-term thing. And the, you know, the PSC may change makeup over time as well as city council. You know, we want this to work for a really long period of time. This commission will always have the opportunity to, you know, to raise our voices at every step of the way. I mean, that, you know, I'm not saying that I'm necessarily happy about not being, you know, not being included, because I, you know, we've all been frustrated with the narrow approval criteria for his, you know, for getting on the National Register. It's not necessarily reflective of the comprehensive plan. And I think this commission feels like we have actually a pretty good handle on, you know, comprehensive plan goals, maybe more than, you know, some. But I'll just leave it at that. We certainly, you know, can get into the nitty gritty there. In terms of designating individual resources, I do have some concerns about moving it closer into a city process, because as much as that is outside of your scope, it does take money, you know, and making people kind of go through that city process and pay money to do it when, you know, currently they kind of get that for free, you know, by going through the National Register is problematic for me. I'm going to have to think about that. But there's so much good work here. So I am definitely volunteering to be one of the, you know, in-depth readers. I do need hard copies of all this material to, you know, to put down my pages and make notes and all of that. And I hope other commissioners will join me in that. I really need your voices. Derek Spears, excellent. Thank you. That is fabulous. Who else? I mean, I'm hoping.
I'm willing to.
Commissioner Roman, thank you. You were by my side in the last round. And
Can I ask a question just while we still have Brandon? And I guess I want to share Commissioner Spears' comments earlier and just now Commissioner Miner's concerns over the historic district process, because I don't have a lot of optimism that the Planning Commission wants more historic districts. I think that they're often at odds with their overall planning goals. And so I'm, as you note, the process of Bureau of Planning and Sustainability and then to the Planning Commission and then to City Council, I'm wondering if you can describe how you see the public being involved in that and through the lens of historically underserved communities that have often had planning commissions bulldoze their neighborhoods all for the sake of progress. And so I'm curious, how does the public initiate, you know, a historic district process that isn't, you know, squelched every time by a planning commission that has, albeit competing goals that they might prioritize over historic preservation, and maybe their own charge and who makes up that commission needs to change, because you know they need obviously some more historic preservation expertise if they're going to balance historic preservation versus those other goals. I'm concerned that we're setting up a process that looks great, but it'll never actually achieve a goal of creating a new historic district. The rest of the work I love.
I'll just respond with one thing. I know these are discussions that the commission will need to have. And that's the district designation process for National Register would work the same. And that you may see areas that go on the National Register, use Peacock Lane, for example, who can make the case to Planning Commission and City Council that they ought to be designated at one of the higher levels, conservation or historic, because of their value to the community. Similarly, because of the more broad criteria that we've included for the historic and conservation level for designation, there may be areas of the city that aren't eligible for National Register listing that could be really good candidates for one of our local resource designation types. It would be incumbent on city staff, Landmarks Commission, the public, to put together a proposal to do that and to be convincing and compelling at Planning and Sustainability Commission and City Council for why those places should be designated. And I often think that the strength of the protection program is only as strong as the buy-in for the designation. And one of the themes that's embedded in the amendments is thinking about if there's not broad public buy-in and purpose behind designating a resource, there won't be that broad public investment in protecting the resource later on. And something that's been on my mind with these new campaigns to create larger National Register districts, that maybe those people who live within the district might support it, but unless and until the full community is brought on, the willingness to protect may not be there. And so I think these are all really great questions, especially because we're moving into a universe that we haven't done in 35 or more years. Back before 1993, all district designation decisions were a result of the city council making a decision to protect. That's where we saw those conservation districts. That's where we saw the Skidmore, Old Town, and Yamhill districts. But in a lot of ways, these proposals bring us back to what we were doing before the mid-1990s. How those work and whether they could work better, I think that's where your expertise will really be helpful.
Well, with that said, I do want to commend all the hard work you've done, Brandon. It's been a long road to hoe, and you've really stayed a steady hand on the wheel through all of this. And so I look forward to reading the draft. So thank you.
I will say there were a lot of late nights over the last 6 weeks. So when you find a typo, blame it on 1 a.m. brain and let me know. But
no problem.
Yeah, I think that's something I would love to tie into as well as Commissioner Spears, but it's really kind of just tying off what we already said is that there's like a couple different things that I want to focus on. I am very interested in how it got to the PSC and not HLC. I'm interested in how that happened because I do hear the other concerns, which are extremely valid. I love to hear that they are broadening who they're allowing to join the commissions, because I think that does allow more public to be involved, because there are a lot of hindrances of what that looked like if you fit certain criteria. I think the third part is one of my most challenging pieces I've had being here is being relegated into whatever the current standard is and having to make a decision based on that, knowing that I really want that not to happen and I want to have more power and more freedom to be able to challenge whatever that is without the fear of being removed or retaliated or anything else. And to know that I'm going to have a city council who will back that up. So we've had some tough conversations here in the past month or so. And it's been very challenging to really feel powerless in a conversation and have to remove myself from it because I don't know how to make that decision. I don't know how to say yes to something I can't stand for. And that's extremely challenging and puts people in a hard position. So I want to know and that was part of a survey that came out about commission, you know, how do we make this better? And it's like, you really need to have an opportunity to set a precedent and to just be able to say no. and to be able to do that and push the narrative somewhere else for the change. And if that's part of the conversation, how we do that, that has to be part of the process as well, to be able to allow the commissions their full authority to, one, truly enforce. But when there's a situation where we need to have a true change happen, affordable housing, density issues, conservation, things like that, we need to have a chance to not have to push back to our little book and say, well, we have to do this because of our job. We have to do this because we are people here on behalf of the public, and they don't get a chance to be here. So we have to be able to say no and stand up against that and then take it wherever it comes from, you know, and hope that our city council hears that message. And so I hope that's part of the conversation too, and part of the process, that we get to allow ourselves to do that independently and not have to default back. So, you know, again, this is just, these are all the things I've had to grapple with in the past couple of months or so in just doing this and trying to stay moving forward doing this. And I hope that's part of the conversation. And if I had to talk to someone like Dan Ryan and any of the people who are now tied to us or anything else, it's exactly what I want. And I want to know, how devoted are you really to us making some change? Because the change is going to come from these other lower organizations to push back on the narrative and push back on the norms that are there. And it's a system, and it's been set up. And we need to have a chance and an opportunity to truly have the authority to say no and not personally feel like I can be removed if I say no too many times, because I don't want that to happen, but to literally be rewarded for standing up for the people you're actually serving. So that would be that's one of my other big pressing things is through this whole process is, what is that conversation when it comes to us, when we stand in these positions and we're doing this on behalf of the city? I don't want to be thrust in another position where I don't feel like I have a choice, because I will recuse myself and I will step out, and I have no problem moving away because I don't want to do that again. And I don't think anybody else does, but we're trying to do our job as volunteers and also trying to, you know, represent our communities that we really want to have change. So I hope that's part of the narrative in the conversation as well, because that will allow more people to be involved in the process to truly affect the change they're trying to have happen down the road, with, again, without the fear of the other things happening. So I hope that's part of the conversation as we continue to do this. And I hope we get maybe a city council in person involved and get them in one of these conversations so we can have that as well.
One area, Commissioner Spears, that I'll be especially excited for your feedback on is the proposed demolition review approval criteria and process. Because one thing we've heard for many years is that in these conservation districts in North Northeast Portland, they're all in North Northeast Portland, that there has been willy-nilly demolition of some really significant buildings. And today those buildings are subject to demolition delay, and there's no opportunity for the community to meaningfully engage in stopping a demolition, mitigating for its loss, looking at alternatives. And so in expanding demolition review to those places, and to areas that in the future might get designated as a conservation level resource, we have this opportunity to look at what are the criteria that get used when a proposal comes in the door, because there are plenty of buildings throughout the city that are in districts or individual landmarks where there may be a higher and better use that comes along in the future. And we want to be able to give the decision maker the ability to make that tough decision that there's a more pressing public value to demolish the building than to keep it. But we also want to be able to have the criteria there to be able to say no, and saying no makes the most sense. And so I'll be especially interested in a variety of things, but that demo review authority is something that only exists in historic areas and in areas that are significant for cultural history, and areas that are significant for social history, that it may have some great architecture, but that their histories really are about what happened within the walls of the building. I think we've got some room to get more creative about how do we weigh and evaluate proposed demolition, and is there a way for us to look at maintaining cultural continuity, even if it means a building that is from the historic period comes down or gets replaced when it makes sense. So I struggled a lot with those criteria. I think your eyes on them would be really helpful. I know people are gonna have different thoughts about it.
I just wanna know this as a priority. Of what the city is really trying to do to rectify a situation and try to move forward. I want to know it's a priority, because I don't know if I feel that way and think that way sometimes. And just going through the past year of doing just even a simple trying to create a business program, and to hear the information and the feedback I'm getting from different places, I don't know if that is a priority to preserve. I don't know if the priority is that, because we know that I've learned now that it's easier to take a resource, a national resource, and remodel it from the inside and actually update it, and it does less carbon emissions and all these things we've learned, but that doesn't always lead to the other word we have to do is profit. And I find too many times we're having a conversation of not trying to preserve, but trying to figure out how to make money. And that puts me in a very tough position as a commissioner, as a person, and trying to see that within a city. And again, I want to know that this is a priority of what we are trying to address and do, and that we can, and if it is, does it supersede the money and the profit and the developers and the other things that come in? Because I hear a lot of things tied back to the business on how we are identifying places, who gets the authority to say whether they can do a district, where are the people involved? Because I can tell you right now, as a business owner, I love that. I love that. But as a person who may not have a business, where are they involved in the process, and where's their threshold? Where's their 50%, 25% of buy-in? And it goes back down to that same narrative. And again, I want to help businesses, but we have a lot more people in this city than we have businesses. And a lot of the conversations really shifted towards, kind of from what I've seen, and just in one place. And I'm just trying to figure out, is this going to be a priority? And are we actually going to do something with this to move forward? And again, I love all the hard work. It's just the hard questions that I have. And I want to know that we really do have to buy in, because I know the people on this call agree with this conversation and want these things. My concern is that when we get this conversation of those who can actually affect and make the change and push the button, what does that look like? And what is their buy-in in this conversation to push something forward? Because again, this is where the great intention of something can get squashed really quick, because the room can change. And when the people in the room change and they choose the priority, what happens? And I think that's what Chair Minor was talking about earlier. You shift the room and somebody changes. We're not here. Somebody else is in PSC. Somebody's in city council, and we shift the room. What happens? And so those are my concerns. So that's just where I'm at in this conversation. But I'm definitely looking forward to going through the process and continue to talk about it. It's just where I'm left at, and what does that look like?
So I will just say in response partly to what you're bringing up, which I think is a really, you know, it's a really great point. We have definitely seen a lot of we've seen a lot of push, I think, from elected officials that, you know, we need density and they know best how to do it, right? So not necessarily valuing preservation as one strategy. But let's do, you know, what we can to read this new code using what we said our own goals are, you know, I mean, equity, right? Affordability, sustainability. And let's try to really pull it back to, you know, what does this code look like through those, you know, the lens of those goals, and try to prioritize what we can do. I mean, I agree. We have felt the giant thumb coming down on us on occasion, and we probably will again. I really value, you know, having you on the commission. I think you're helping to bring a great viewpoint, and you know, this is not an easy process, but we can make an impact.
Yeah, and I'm completely on board. I want to make sure I always continue to state that I am completely on board with what's moving forward. The questions I just want to leave on the table, knowing that they're probably going to be addressed at a different time. But we got here with what we are talking about because there were questions that had to be had and things we had to deal with. And this is just the same thing I want to leave. I want to know we're doing something now, but we have questions on the table that still aren't answered. We have to move to, and have to have those type of conversations. I don't want to make sure they're just left there. They don't have to be addressed or stamped at this point in time, and I don't expect that by any means. I just want to make sure we know we have the dialogue and the conversation so we can continue the progress we're trying to get towards while also doing what we're doing right now, because it's great work and I love it. So I'm very thankful for that part. I don't ever want to stop the movement. I just want to make sure that we continue the narrative and the conversation.
Okay.
Could I just add something to in response to what Chair Minor was saying? You noted that sometimes the commission has had the thumb pressed on you guys. I think we should also, when we're reading this code, think about how this code is the thumb and whether those regulations are necessary to achieve the goals that we're trying to achieve. That's all.
Yeah. Awesome. Okay. I know we're getting late. Does anyone have any thoughts to add to that, or shall we go ahead and adjourn our meeting?
Yeah, I just want to say, Commissioner Spears, I really appreciate your perspective and approach on all this. It's really, it makes me realize how much work I have to do, you know? So, and I appreciate you bringing it to this venue. Thank you.
Ernestina, are you muted? Oh. Darn, we can't hear what, Commissioner.
I just Barnett. Heard a little bit, but maybe if you yell. Okay, how about Ernestina, why don't you send me your comments and I'll forward them to the group.
Darn.
Yeah. Okay.
What I use, I know Chair Minor wants a hard copy. If anybody wants a hard copy of the code and or staff report, send me your best mailing address. And I will send those out as I get your mailing address.
Sorry, so if you're just
email me and I'll send your mailing address. Email your mailing address, I'll send them out as soon as I get it.
Perfect. Okay.
So Brandon, the process is gonna be us making some recommendations, and then the final, the final code changes will be Planning Sustainability Commission going to City Council. Approximately how far out are we looking? Is this, I mean, kind of where are we at in terms of, are we getting close to a final presentation to City Council? And I mean, do you feel like we're getting close here, or?
We are. I think this is where the code leaves the BPS BDS hands and is out for at this point it's up to the decision maker. So at this point, staff have let it go, where tomorrow we'll be letting it go. Planning Commission will probably take the remainder of this year in work sessions, depending on what they hear and depending on where they feel like additional amendments are necessary. That's where your comments will inform them, and they may be bringing you into their discussions to make their formal recommendation to council. We're hoping that happens at the end of the year, and then we'll be at council sometime in the spring for final adoption. So there's still room to move these amendments. That will need to be Planning Commission and or City Council to make that move. So at this point, it is out for the public. It is going to be up to what testimony comes in and what is compelling for changing what it is that staff has recommended.
Thank you.
And I think Commissioner Spears is on to a really good thread, and that's a thread that's embedded in these amendments, and it's a matter of the degree in which we're moving the needle. Previous to 3 years ago, with the exception of a very small number of individual landmark decisions, the National Register was how we made designation decisions. And the National Register as you all know, is a really important tool. It's a tool that has served Portland really well. For individual listings, it's been an administrative efficiency that other cities haven't had, but it has also meant that we have a couple of categories of resources that are really represented, and then a whole bunch of resource categories and themes that aren't represented at all. And so it has left us in a place where, to Commissioner Spears's point, there is a group of the public who have been really engaged and who have used the National Register, and it has worked well for their purposes, but it has not served all geographies or communities of the city in a way that a new program, new criteria, could theoretically do a better job at. Whether we got that right or not, that's what you guys are going to need to help PSC understand.
All right. I think we can go ahead and adjourn our meeting. I know that we'll have some offline work to do, and Commissioner Roman and Spears, the three of us will probably need to each, just review and then discuss a little bit, as sort of a subcommittee, and be prepared to testify at the PSC, with whatever we sort of conclude as our, representing this body's desires. Sound good? Okay. Take care, everybody. Yeah, seriously.
Don't breathe too much of that air.
I know. Yeah.
It's good to see you.
Thanks. Meeting's adjourned.
Hey, thank you.
Good night.